determines how much the needle deflects, and you call that ohm. So in all cases, when I want to know impedance, I have to put a signal through it in one direction or the other. Can you thoroughly, passively measure the impedance? Well, there are guys who will say, I will disturb the impedance that I receive, and I'm listening to nothing but noise of the universe. I'm not putting on a signal, just listening to the noise, and I tune the receiver until I get the maximum noise. Guess what? The noise of the universe is a transmitter. So whenever you want to measure impedance, I don't care if it's to measure the number of ohms of the resistor sitting on the table, or measure the exact impedance of your transmission line connected to your antenna, you have to put a signal through it. And what you're really doing left-handedly is you're finding out what impedance gives the best energy flow. Or you're measuring voltage and current combination and calculating impedance and phase angle and calculating reactance, and therefore you know what the exact impedance is. So to measure impedance, you've got to supply a signal. Ain't that crazy? N2APG, K2RIW.
This is N2APG. Well, that makes sense. That's why I was wondering if there was, some other device, that hams could use to play with their antennas without transmitting into it, so to speak. I guess MFJ makes that, they actually make that little, couple hundred dollar device. It's a combination meter and frequency counter and all that stuff. That sends a signal up the antenna and, does the same thing. So I guess that's a poor man's network analyzer, right?
It sure is, Dave. And there's one other thing you could do. Connect your antenna through a antenna tuner into your receiver and jiggle the knobs on the antenna tuner until you get the maximum signal into the receiver. Whether it be noise that you're listening to or signal you're listening to, almost doesn't matter. On that particular frequency, you could calibrate your antenna tuner such that the number 30 on the left-hand dial and number 14 on the right-hand dial, you look up on a chart and it tells you exactly what impedance you're looking at. Which what you're really doing when you're pushing the dial and making the best S-meter deflection is you're creating impedance that gives you the best power transfer. And then if you want to, when you get that best impedance power transfer, then you could go and make a bunch of measurements on the network analyzer, on the antenna tuner, and find out what it is seeing at the antenna side. There's lots of ways you can do it. But you're really sending a signal through it one way or the other. There's almost no getting around that. And so, fun type stuff, and it's a darn good measurement. Now, there's a couple of catches here. I know that Mel would love to get in on this one, and that is because his particular antenna tuner on his full wave 80 meter loop antenna, because his antenna tuner is a little bit more complicated than the one you and I are likely to use. Let me drop. He not only can change the impedance on his 600 ohm transmission line, the impedance between the two lines, but he can independently measure, change the impedance from each line to ground. So he's measuring, he is dithering the differential impedance, that's the impedance between the two wires, and he's also dithering the common mode impedance, that's the impedance between the wires and ground. Because he can dither that antenna tuner in two different ways simultaneously, he is really swishing his antenna performance in polarization and doing some electronic steering of that antenna. Therefore, he can make the noise go up and down in ways that are different and a little bit more complicated than just getting the best impedance match. And he's discovered multiple times that because he's listening to a guy in, let's say, London, and that signal in London is coming at a certain angle and a certain polarization as it arrives in Brooklyn, he finds that as he disturbs those knobs, there are times when he makes the standing wave ratio worse as far as the transmitter is concerned, but the amount of signal-to-noise ratio of that guy in London gets better because he is maximizing the polarization and the angle of arrival. So there are times when you can sacrifice good impedance matching and getting better performance. Mel has been doing that, and people have given him a lot of flack for years, and they're slowly coming around to say, whoa, this guy's onto something. And there's one other place where it happens. Let me drop. When it comes to your UHF and SHF transistors, every transistor generates an amount of noise, I'm talking about a low noise amplifier now, an amount of noise that's proportional to what impedance it sees. And when you go to the data sheet on some of the better transistors, you'll find out that if you intentionally mismatch the input leads of that transistor, particular phase angle of a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. That's a certain little circular area out to one corner on the Smith chart, so to speak. You go to that particular corner of the Smith chart, and the way you match your particular low noise transistor, although you're losing a little bit of the signal because of an impedance mismatch, because the crazy characteristics within that transistor means that the amount of noise the transistor is generating decreases more rapidly than the impedance mismatch loss of signal, you come out ahead. So that when you tune most of these low noise transistors for the best noise figure, in many cases you're tuning it for a very specific amount of 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. And the best impedance match of the transistor doesn't give you the best low noise performance. And on a very quiet band like a 1296 or 10 gigs, the lowest noise figure is more important than getting best energy transfer when you're receiving. So, for a bunch of reasons, always tuning for the lowest VisWatt isn't necessarily the whole story. Wonder if you've ever heard of some of that before, Dave. N2ABG, K2LIW?
Well, I have noticed when I was active on the low bands that, you know, obviously by twisting the dials on your antenna transmatch, you would affect the, you know, the incoming signal strength. And, I never experimented further as far as, you know, to correlate between the best SWR and the, you know, the best signal strength, but that was just something that I was kind of wondering about. Okay, I know it, Mel probably wants to get to the mailbag. It's after 9 o'clock, so I'm not going to delay it any further. Glad you like the Ballmark stuff. I just stumbled upon that today. Real quick, apparently there were basically two installations on the East Coast around New York, one at West Hampton Beach and one over by McGuire Air Force Base. 56 missiles at West Hampton and 56 plus at McGuire, and from what I read, they were all nuclear tipped.
And the best guess is the Hiroshima bomb was something like 13 kilotons of atomic bomb. And those nuclear tips on these missiles, and many of them were on Long Island at one time in the late 50s and 60s, were numbers like 10, 20, and 30 kilotons of nuclear explosion. In other words, we had multiple missiles on Long Island with bombs that were similar to, and sometimes a little bit less, and sometimes quite a bit more, than the Hiroshima bomb. Sobering thought. Thank goodness that Cold War is over. Okay. We've got Alan, KC2RFN, and Eric, KC2WIE, waiting in the wings. We normally switch over to 9 o'clock because the younger people that mail things to Mel have to go to bed earlier, so we're going to go over to Mel's mailbag right now, and then we'll pick up those two guys in that order. KC2, KEY, what kind of burning questions have you getting this week, Mel? K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Yep. It's a never-ending story, I should say. The experiments have been questioned many times what I need so much sophisticated, expensive equipment for antenna measurement when you can go out and buy a off-the-shelf SWR meter and supposedly adjust things up and you're in business. A lot more to the story, as you say, Dick. Anybody interested in past discussions that we've had, look back on the amateurradio.tv, and I should say we discussed it quite a bit in detail in the past. Alright, looking through some questions here. Now here's an interesting one. Down in Florida, my parents have got a home. I want to put an antenna there, but they said, no, you're not going to put anything really that is going to disturb the area. But I see there's a number of flagpoles. Can I encase my vertical in a flagpole made out of PVC pipe? I've heard that PVC pipe will disturb the operation of a vertical antenna. Is that correct or not?
As I see it, Mel, there's a yes and a no to that. If I had I'm going to pick a number, 20-meter or 40-meter ground plane antenna, properly set up with ground plane radios on the ground in my backyard in Florida, and now I slip a PVC pipe over that vertical radiator section, assuming it doesn't have a bunch of tuning coils and I can do this. Yes, the capacity capacitive loading of the PVC pipe is going to, in general, bring that antenna down to a lower frequency. If I'm willing to readjust the length of this simple 40-meter down ground plane antenna, I'm right back in full operation. The PVC pipe at HF frequencies has a radio absorption characteristic or a loss tension characteristic that's very desirable. In other words, radio-wise, that PVC pipe is almost thoroughly transparent. It does have some local capacitance, which tunes things a little bit lower, but that in itself is not a showstopper. So is the PVC pipe going to kill it? If you're not smart enough to do some retuning, you might be a little unhappy with the performance. Can you design an antenna that is inside the PVC pipe that works like a charm? No doubt about it. If that flagpole out in your front of your family's house, let me drop, is made out of a chunk of wood that's not heavily water-soaked, there's nothing stopping you from running a wire up the side of that flagpole, and although it looks like a flagpole, it's also got a wire alongside of it, and it's a beautiful antenna. Nobody will be the wiser. There are a number of books, and I could go over to my bookshelf right now and pick up a book which tells you how to, under war conditions, set up antennas that don't show. Well, your local zoning board may represent the war board as far as you're concerned, and there's lots of ways that you can make the flagpole, the downspout gutters, the rain gutters, wires inside the attic, the lightning arrestor system. There's all kinds of ways that you create an antenna in Florida, for instance, that the zoning board is not going to see, and yet will give you some darn good performance. On top of that, very few people see wire. If you set up simple wire dipoles that are not painted with day glow red paint, I think very few people are going to say, gee, that's unsightly and I don't want that there. So there's lots of ways to put up an antenna in your apartment building or in your rent controlled or your closed community in Florida, which will not show and yet you get pretty good performance out of them. I bet you've heard lots of stories along these lines. So K2KEY, K2RIW, and TechNet.
Roger. I was really curious of using the PVC pipe. I didn't realize that it does have some conductivity in the way of a capacitance at HF. I didn't really believe that it really would make that much of an effect on the antenna. Yeah, this is a problem. A friend of mine wound up, oh boy, he did quite a bit of hocus pocus there, with also a vertical antenna, and the bottom where the matching network is, I planted like flowers around it, but how they stuck it in there. Because he had told me, in fact, tales that before he went ahead and was able to put the antenna outside, get the radios buried and everything, that he says they passed by somebody, and he got an inquiry. He wanted to know why he was using his mobile whip at the time, and the wire was pulled through the window to his rig in the house. And they questioned him, why is there a wire connected from your car to the house through the window? Can you imagine that? Over.
Well, I'd like to believe that any reasonable Board of Zoning Appeals or closed community control or whatever, where they're trying to control the beauty of the community, will not get that deep unless you've done something else. If you've made a nuisance to yourself, to your neighbors, and you've got the wrong attitude, they're going to find an excuse. It's very similar to if you upset the living daylights out of your local police department, they're going to make sure that they're going to pull you over if there's a headlight that's not full brilliance or a taillight that's not full brilliance or it's not blinking at the right time and you're not stopping long enough at the stop sign, whatever. You can find reasons. So if they're finding things like this, quite possibly there's something else going on. But the main reason for this, I presume, is beauty. The aesthetic appeal of some communities are such that they won't let you change the color of the paint on the side of your house or the color of the paint on your mailbox without getting their permission. They've got that kind of control. I wouldn't choose to live in one of those communities. Most ham radio operators wouldn't. But there's ways around that. And so a amateur radio operator has got to realize, let me drop, although you may not think so, you are an oddball. In most of the progressive countries in the world, there's roughly one ham radio operator per 500 in the general population. That means what? 0.2 2% of the population is a ham radio operator. That makes you kind of a rare animal. So you are an oddball. And as such, you've got to work pretty hard at keeping peace in the community. Those people who live in the adjacent houses to you, real estate-wise, they're living in your pocket, so to speak. You better treat them well. And if they're getting some television interference, you ask them when is their favorite television program, and you won't go on during that time until you cure the problem with the right kind of a filter or whatever. Be compliant. Be friendly. Be helpful. And if you can fix some electronic appliance of theirs, and that'll give you some money in the bank, if you know what I mean, psychologically speaking, go and do it. Because you've got to admit you're an oddball. You're doing things that, if they want to get crazy, they can become paranoid and say that you're emitting RF radiation and you're hurting the health of them and their children. I mean, they can hop into some craziness like that. So we got to be friendly. We got to be compliant. We got to be helpful in order for everything to go smoothly. You can easily say, let me drop. I know a number of people who on Long Island, among other places, when they got a complaint from the neighbor, said, get out of here. The Federal Communications Commission has given me a license. What I'm doing is legal. You have no control of it. Don't even bother complaining to me. Don't even come onto my property. Get the heck out of here. You say words like that to your neighbor, and I guarantee you have just gone to step number 1, 2, and 3 of establishing a range war. And pretty soon there's going to be a petition going around in the community, and life is going to get very complicated. You didn't gain anything by saying those words, but my goodness, did you create a problem. If you've got half a brain, you ain't going to do that. You're going to be friendly. Those are my suggestions. I bet you've been friendly with your neighbors, obvious by the fact that you're so damn friendly with them that if you want to hang an antenna on their house, they let you do it. How the hell did you do that? K-U-K-E-Y, K-U-R-I-W.
They sure have cultivated it, and I'm lucky I do have really great people on all sides of me here. Otherwise, I wouldn't have up a 160-meter dipole that extends 3 houses south and 3 houses to my north. I use that dipole. In fact, we have had this 160-meter CW contest running this week, that weekend. Started Friday night and ended this morning at 11 o'clock in the morning. And I participated only on a friendly basis with a best of my friend, good friendly competition with my friend in Pennsylvania, being that we're both on the same East Coast. Basically, we have similar setups and everything. So I says, okay. He says, all right, only 3 hours, Mel, and I'll trust that you'll give me the right count. Trust that I'll... Yeah, I said, okay, right, when we get together, I'll treat you to an ice cream cone or something. So I was able to get on 160 with my dipole, which I could say is a full-length dipole on 160, so imagine how much real estate you need. And let me let it drop. The only way I was able to do that is have the cooperation. Not only that, the wonderful neighbor's cooperation, but I also get volunteers. I don't know what you're doing, Mel, but we'll help you do it, and that's it. So one neighbor even said, I said, yeah, your roof has no antennas. You don't mind, I use it. So he said, you kind of climb up there, be my guest. He said, but you better have your own insurance. He says, well, I'm not going to cover you if you fall. Things like that. So I cultivated. I have my snow thrower. I mean, I do things like that. I have my snow thrower in the winter that comes out and cleans the sidewalk up and down the block. And things like that. I make sure nobody's, you know, around because they're on vacation, that I check their homes and make sure to put out the garbage pails to take in. You got to do that. I explained that many times that you can't take be a belligerent, you know, and there's a complaint, you've got to address it and see what you can do and say, excuse me, let me see what I can do. And I always send bails to, you know, reconcile the situation. So that's the advice I give. Okay, one more.
Comment then?
Yep. Alan first, and then you, Alan, just pass it back to Mel for his next one. You got it, Alan.
Okay, KC2RFN, very quickly. You know, you're talking about the cultivating of neighborly and that is a really important point for the ham radio operator, because I have come to find that they view us as a selfish oddball type who are looking to have fun at their expense, the expense being interference to their radios and televisions and interference to the beauty of the neighborhood. But I found there's an easy way to break down the wall, and Melly, you hit it right on the head with the snowblower. I use the snowblower, which I enjoy using anyway, because it's self-powered, it's so easy to use. Even on the worst snowstorms, I just do my neighbor's driveways and do the sidewalk and part of the street, and you instantly earn a following of people who see you as a nice guy, not a selfish guy. And then the other thing I've done with several of my neighbors was to bring them into the shack and show them that, you know, we're not some sort of oddballs with, you know, filth and books and, you know, a general untidiness and unpleasantness all around the regular home. With a room with some equipment. And I always explain it to them in terms of CB radio, because they can all understand that. And then I turn on the radio to a local AM station first, and then tune around from there. And I just did this literally yesterday with one of my neighbors, and we were able to make a contact into the Azores right at that time. It was perfect. He was fascinated by it. And when I went back to his house to help him with a TV problem he was having, he was telling his wife about it in great detail with great excitement. So that's a way to win over your neighbors, is let them see that it's not you're not just sitting in your basement talking to people around the world at their expense. I thought that might be useful. Over you to Mel, KC2 RFM.
Well done, Alan. Go ahead, Mel.
Exactly. You got to want respect. Like they said 130 years ago, man said, want respect, you got to earn respect. And basically, that's the bottom line. You want to pick up anything else right now, Dick? I think if somebody else had a query, then we maybe try one more, over.
Yeah, we're waiting for another one of your great questions. Go right ahead, Mel.
Okay, now in fact, I'm looking here right now. Here's a question that's been asked. Again, with antennas, so clandestine hidden things and all that kind of goody. Is it practical to use one set of radio for two verticals simultaneously? And which frequency do you use? Is it the lower frequency? Will that cover, well, again, you know, it's just subjective, but all right, let's see what you think. Using two different verticals for and one set of radios, Dick, because of the situation that again, you just can't make the place. This is another thing that I must bring out. Got to keep it neat. Even though I have, like you say, a lot of antennas things here, I have a lot of shrubbery. I don't go chopping up things, shrubbery by my location nor my neighbor's location. I'm very conscious not to make any kind of mess, start chopping away at branches of the trees or disturbing flower beds or lawns or anything. This is another point. Go ahead, Dick.
When it comes to using multiple radios and one set of ground planes, there's multiple ways of doing it. The two ground plane antennas could be almost co-located, very close to each other, or it could be on opposite ends of the property. And lots of people have a bunch of, what's the word for it now, old wives' tales or misconceptions as to what the radios are really doing. The most basic of all antennas is a dipole. And if I've got a dipole in free space, at one instant of time, the right-hand side of the dipole is positive, the left-hand side is negative. I can put a sheet of metal at right angles to the dipole, right down the middle, a normal sheet of metal, as it's called, and it doesn't do to any disturbance. There is a neutral plane at right angles to the dipole, right down the center. I can put a sheet of metal there, go out to infinity in all directions on that sheet of metal. It makes no change of the gain, the impedance, or the antenna pattern of the dipole. Once I've got that sheet of metal there, I can decide that I'm going to feed the sheet of metal with reference to the right-hand side of the dipole, and I'm going to throw away the left-hand side. And then I'm going to rotate the whole thing 90 degrees and lay it against my ground. That is a vertical ground plane antenna. The other half of the dipole is there,
It is there electronically as the mirror image in that sheet of metal. The dipole, the remaining dipole, doesn't know anything has happened. Now, so your ground plane radios in the ideal world are trying to act as a sheet of metal that goes out to infinity in all directions. Let me drop. As such, you and I don't want to lay down a sheet of copper across our whole darn backyard. It would be very expensive, and there's a whole bunch of other disadvantages. And it might disturb the flower beds for the white, but you know what I mean. And someone's discovered that if you lay down a couple of pieces of wire that are each a quarter wavelength long, you'll end up with much of the benefit of that great big sheet of metal. But that's what you're trying to do. You're trying to simulate a great big sheet of metal. So if your ground plane radials are longer than they have to be, that's good. If there's more of them than the antenna manufacturer recommended, that's good. Once you put the ground plane radios down, enough of them and long enough, you can put down vertical antennas all over that backyard that pick up the local ground plane radios, if you know what I mean. And if you want to be a purist, you'll put some other radios out from the second antenna if it's far away from the first antenna. The main purpose of the ground plane radios is to act as a counterpoise, to act as the other half of the dipole, to make the dirt in your backyard look like a sheet of metal. What you're trying to do, if you want the highest possible efficiency, let me drop, is you'd like the ground plane radios to be long enough so the antenna can't see real close by dirt, and you'd like the spacing between the ground plane radios to be a small enough fraction of a wavelength that the RF energy from the main radiator can't reach between those two ground plane radios and see the dirt, because the dirt is a dummy load. If you've got too few ground plane radials and you make a careful calculation and measurement, computer modeling or whatever, of the total efficiency of your antenna. It's what the cell phone people call TRP, total radiated power. If you could integrate over full 360 degrees of space and azimuth and elevation, all 4 pi stair radians of space, and look at the total amount of power radiated versus the power you're putting in. You put in 100 watts and you find out that your TRP is only 50 watts. That means 50 watts was either dissipated in the resistance of the components of your antenna or the dirt in your backyard. The majority of the time it's the dirt. And you're keeping the dirt a little bit warmer, and the worms are happier in the wintertime, but that's not exactly what you're trying to do. So elevating the antenna, putting down more ground plane radials, all of these things make sure that less and less of the RF energy sees the dirt in your backyard, which is a partially radio-absorptive property material. And when it absorbs that RF energy, it turns it into heat and it's gone forever. So with that philosophy, the more metal you connect to those ground plane radios, the more of them, the more their length, the more the efficiency of your antenna. And if you can raise the whole antenna above the ground, now you can get away with very few ground plane radios because the dirt of the ground is further away, and you'll end up with more signal on the horizon because you're getting up above the local terrain and all of their obstacles. So maybe that helps. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yep, this is K2KEY. Yeah, but in fact, I got another thought. I didn't realize the person that asked me about the antenna was putting his parents' yard there, front yard in Florida, also asked if he's homebrewing the vertical. Is it an advantage that inside the PVC pipe and he's using, if he went ahead and used copper pipe and used length of copper pipe, aluminum pipe, or a wire, which would you prefer? Does it make really much of a difference? You know, well, all the antennas I've ever seen outside, you know, other than dipoles, things of that sort. A vertical's always been a aluminum pipe with antennas and things like that. I don't know how much of an advantage would it be to buy, say, a copper water pipe and make it out of that, Dick. What do you think, over?
Yeah, I've got some opinions on this one, Mel. And there's a curve in a book, and there's a curve on a website that we can all go to. In fact, the website itself is on amateurradio.tv. I'm talking about the, I can't even think of the two guys' names now. These two guys in 1947 took a whole lot of data. And so once you know the diameter of the antenna and the length of the antenna, the resistive component of its impedance and the reactive components of the impedance, it's thoroughly predictable. Brown and Woodward. Mr. Brown and Mr. Woodward, 1947, did a man year of work and measured all the possible diameters of antennas. The bottom line of this is that if you're using reasonably good copper wire to begin with, your dipole antenna is going to have, let me pick a number, 98% efficiency, because it's got a good conductive characteristic. As you make the dipole larger and larger in diameter, let me drop. Slowly at first and a little bit faster later on, you start picking up a little bit more bandwidth. But the rate at which you pick up bandwidth compared to the number of dollars you've got to spend and the amount of effort you've got to put forward, unless you're a purist, it might not be a good investment. And by the way, I should mention that the PVC pipe is a kind of a plastic. It's an exotic plastic, but it's a plastic. Every kind of plastic in micarta and Lexan and polycarbonate, any of these resistive materials, wood that's dry, any of these resistive materials that you can buy, build or whatever, all have a dielectric constant greater than air. They all act to a small degree like a capacitor. No matter what you put around the antenna of a resistive material, it is a small increase in capacitance. That's not a showstopper. It's just something you might have to tune for, model for, or test for, if you know what I mean. Let me drop. So once you've decided to, for whatever reason, line your antenna with PVC pipe, and now down the center of that PVC pipe, should you put aluminum wire, it'll work like a charm if it's big enough in diameter, because even though aluminum has a lot more resistance than copper, the resistance becomes smaller and smaller when the aluminum wire is larger and larger in diameter. So aluminum wire, if you can make good contact to it, works like a charm. And as you start going to fatter and fatter pieces of copper pipe inside of that PVC, you'll pick up a slight increase in bandwidth, an extremely small increase in efficiency, because the original wire already was giving you 90-some-odd%. So is it worth it? Are you willing to spend the dollars and live with all the extra weight? That's up to you. Not very many people are constructing antennas out of copper pipe. The exception to that is a 6-meter halo antenna. That can be constructed out of copper pipe very nicely. But that's operating on a slightly different principle, that antenna. It's not exactly a dipole, if you know what I mean. So, yes, you can go there, but you're not going to get fantastic improvement. A lot more weight, quite a bit more cost. And so, it pays you money and it takes your choice. How many of these antennas have you built out of copper pipe, Mel? I bet you not very many. K2KEY, K2RIW.
K6TTC with a comment.
Okay, stand by a minute, Mel. Go ahead, Hal.
Yeah, Dick, I just wanted to say, if you want to do it light and get bandwidth, make it into a birdcage configuration on each dipole element. Works very well, and it's not heavy.
Excellent suggestion. So if at the beginning of your dipole and the end of your dipole, each one of the wires, you create a crisscross object of two or three objects that are crisscrossed, so that now you've got places to mount four or six wires around the center wire, so to speak. And the center wire doesn't have to be there anymore. And that's what Hal means when he says you're constructing your birdcage. Now, electronically, you're making your antenna look like it's a 4-inch diameter piece of copper pipe, even though it's made out of a four or six individual copper wires. As long as the spacing between the wires is a small enough fraction of a wavelength, you're fooling the living daylights out of the RF. The RF has got very fuzzy eyesight, you could say. It doesn't see the fact that it's not a solid chunk of copper. In fact, because of the so-called skin effect, whether your 6-inch diameter dipole is made out of a thoroughly solid piece of 6-inch diameter copper, which would cost you $1 zillion, or a piece of copper tubing, there's no difference in performance. And then you go the next step from making it from copper tubing into six pieces of parallel wire set up as your birdcage, you get essentially the exact same performance, and now you're down to 0.01% of the amount of copper, and yet you're still getting 99% of the performance. So there's lots of ways you can fool the RF. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yes, Roger. Yeah, well, the gate or birdcage or whatever you want to call that type of configuration, was very popular, of course, during the 30s. In fact, during World War II, I've seen a number of warships. One in particular that was parked in New York City next to the Intrepid was an escort vessel. And it had strung up there an old-fashioned birdcage antenna with the, those days, of course, I don't know if you could find this anymore, but they were using this porcelain type of kit, porcelain three-legged type of separator with a hole in the middle of it where the string of wire went through and then three surrounding wires. So it was a popular antenna with many hands and all through the 30s. I guess it's not too prevalent anymore. But talking about vertical antennas, okay, so copper wire, vertical. Okay, let's say now in a vertical antenna using a PVC pipe, we're homebrewing it. Should we put multiple wires in there? Say, let's say instead of running, one number 12 or 10 wire up the PVC, do you think it would be an advantage to run, say, number of number 12 wires in parallel over?
E2 PSA with a comment.
I think it was N2 PSA. We'll go to you in a second, sir. I think the difference is going to be extremely strong, extremely small, Mel. And is it worth the effort? I doubt it. If you go to amateurradio.tv and you go to the so-called K2RIW dipole antenna or Yagi antenna feeding information, in there you'll find the Brown and Woodward curve. The Brown and Woodward curve shows you for every possible diameter of radiator and every possible length exactly what resistive component and what reactive component you're going to get. When you look at the resistive component, you're going to find out that as you increase the diameter, the resistive component changes extremely slowly, the radiation resistant component. And the reactive component changes almost as slowly. So I think you're going to get very little added benefit, Mel. I'm not sure it's worth the effort. As long as you're starting off with good copper wire with reasonable conductivity in the first place. And these guys are not using, let me drop, they're not using PVC pipe of the diameter of 4, 6, 10, or whatever inches. They're using, you know, 1.5, 2, 3 inches diameter PVC pipe. And so that much extra diameter on 80, 40, 20 meter dipole or monopole, a ground plane, is not going to make much of a difference. Those curves, the Brown and Woodward curves, will tell you exactly what's going to change. And the answer is very little. When you build a birdcage antenna, by the time you build that spreader, you're going for numbers like 6 and 8 or 10 inches in diameter equivalent. And by the way, the spreader itself can be made out of a metallic object. It doesn't have to be an insulated object like porcelain. Your end supports, yes, they're porcelain. But the spreaders themselves, all of those wires are equipotential at that location, and that can be a metallic object. N2 PSA, Papa Sierra Alpha, is what it sounded like. Correct me on the call letter, sir. Give me your name first. My name is Dick. And then go right ahead with your comment on this subject. KQRIW in the TechNet.
I'd like to say good evening to everybody in the net. It's Vinny. And the call sign is KB2 PSI. Kilo Bravo 2, Papa Sierra, India. I have a comment on the birdcage, or I think it may also be called the squirrel cage antenna. The ship in the South Beach seaport is actually called the Ambrose. It's a light ship, and it still has one up there, and it's very easily be seen by visitors. Occasionally, I go down there and operate in the radio room.
Is that open to anybody with a ham radio license, Vinny? Go ahead.
No, it's not. I got to know the folks down there, and there is one other club years ago from Philadelphia that used to maintain the equipment there. When I'm in the neighborhood, I stop by and I open up the room for visitors and operate the equipment. There's a small 10-meter radio down there, and that's what I use to try to load up the cage, the squirrel cage. It's not easy to load. It's a center fed, and as you said, the material, the spreaders are Approximately 10 inches to maybe 12. I'm not sure exactly. I never went up there to measure it. But it is quite long in its sensor bed.
Yeah, in the case of a squirrel cage of that kind of diameter, you do pick up some significant improvement in band width. As the antenna, as the dipole-like antenna or monopole antenna becomes fatter and fatter radio-wise, and the squirrel cage or bird cage effect does that for you, you do create greater and greater bandwidth. It's not the only way to make a dipole more bandwidth, but that's one of the ways. That's the brute force approach. There are other electronic ways. But the exact bandwidth of the dipole is a little bit academic these days, because with a good antenna tuner, you can get all the bandwidth you want out of an antenna as long as your feed line has got a low enough loss. So electronically, you can reestablish whatever bandwidth you want. So does the antenna itself really have to be resonant on the frequency you're operating on? The answer is almost no if your particular antenna tuner has enough range. You say those words, let me drop them. Say those words on the 20-meter band on Saturday afternoon, and there's a whole lot of people that will give you a lot of flack. There's a significant number of people out there, maybe it's 80%, who believe that all the reflected energy coming back from an antenna, because it has standing wave ratio, they believe all that reflected antenna, when it hits the antenna tuner, gets wasted. They really believe that. And it's a tale that somebody came up with and propagated it. Other people believed it. And now it's one of these situations where if you hear it 50 times, you think it's got to be the truth. It is not the truth. Where's that energy going? By conservation of energy. Your antenna tuner is running ice cold. The transmitter is seeing a one-to-one standing wave ratio. There's only one place where that energy can go. It's being re-reflected back up that transmission line for another pass at radiation. And so that's what happens. If your feed line is low enough in loss, you don't care if you have to kick that signal back up the transmission line 10 times in a row. It works. So an antenna tuner, properly used and properly designed, absorbs and wastes no of your RF energy. If you've got 100 watts to radiate, even if your antenna has got a fierce standing wave ratio, your antenna tuner is going to waste less than a watt of it, and 99 watts is going to go into your transmission line and antenna. And if your transmission line is low enough in loss, you will radiate it, even if your antenna is non-resonant. Of course, that sounds controversial, but we can dig deeper into that if you want to. I wonder, got any other hot items there, Mel? K2KEY for one more pass. K2RIW in the TechNet.
2EO, Dick.
Rich recognized Mel first. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, this is K2KEY. First, let me pause. By the way, I've gotten a number of emails that says that they can't get in from outlining areas if we don't wait long enough, Dick. I'm going to take a pause now, so hold on for 10 seconds. Okay, this is K2KEY. All right, because I gave a pause, I will make sure I remind Dick, you, and whoever else that once in a while we've got to give a chance for people to come in via one of the other modes from outlying areas. Yeah, you asked about making an antenna out of copper. Well, I did. And I'll tell you what happened. We needed a 6-meter beam 2 years ago for field day. If you remember, we used to go down to Ryan Visitor Center. So to come up with a 6-meter beam, I was looking and I say, gee, I have to send for some aluminum pipe. I don't have enough aluminum pipe. And I was at Home Depot, and in the bin there, they had cut off pieces of copper pipe, half-inch copper pipe, the old copper. And they were just the right length. So I was able to build a 3-element, 6 feet of beam out of copper pipe. That was my one copper beam antenna that I ever put together. Okay, go ahead.
And my guess is a little bit heavy. And unless you spray it with just the right kind of stuff, it builds up copper oxide and starts looking a little bit homely. But radio-wise, that's a good thing to do. And lots of guys have built copper pipe element beams, and they work. But it's not the only way to go. And a Yagi antenna is a weird mixture of things that are very sensitive and things that are not sensitive. As you change the diameter of the element, you must readjust the length of the element in order for the Yagi to work well. A Yagi is a bunch of parasitic elements that each one has the correct resonant frequency and the right location. You change the diameters and the methods of mounting, and you're probably going to have to change the length to bring them back to the right resonant frequency. And each of your parasitic elements are not resonant at the operating frequency. In the case of directors, they're all above the operating frequency. In the case of the reflector, they're all below the operating frequency. There's a specific frequency they're supposed to be on in order to get the right performance out of that Yagi. Now, I know that Rich into EO was using his, I believe it was a 80-meter dipole on 40 meters, among other things. In other words, he's using it way out of range. And when he's doing it with coax, he was getting a lot of loss. And when he went over to open wire line with the right type kind of an antenna tuner, I think it worked quite well. I wonder if that's approximately what you've experienced, Rich. N2EO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, again, so that's what I wanted to mention. Coax, not very good when you run a mismatch, a high standing wave. But the open wire line, it works fine. I use that antenna on all bands, 80, 40, 20, 15, 10. It's not even resonant on 80 meters. It's a little off. It's a little short because I don't have 132 feet. I've got about 110 or 115 feet I calculated out in an inverted V, feeded with open wire line to a tuner. Works fine on all bands. I have a Cutchcraft R8 vertical, and I would say half the time the vertical is better. The other half the time the inverted V is better, listening, say, on 20 meters. So it's 6 of one, half a dozen of the other. It's done a very good accounting for itself.
Yeah, Rich, an inverted doublet, K6DPZ.
What's the difference between an inverted doublet and an inverted V, Hal? Go ahead.
Inverted doublet is fed with ladder line, and the line is also part of the resonant circuit. So it's an inverted doublet, that's all.
Okay. If my inverted doublet or inverted V is physically a half wave long, and if that transmission line is running at a low standing wave ratio, I'm wondering what's making you think that the transmission line is part of the resonant circuit. Over to you, Hal.
Because you can see a lot of field radiation off the transmission line of the doublet.
Okay. If the antenna is being fed in a balanced manner, a purely differential manner, and the twin lead itself is therefore a balanced structure, and if I'm running a relatively low standing wave ratio, and the power goes up that twin lead once, and if the twin lead near the shack is well shielded, why should the twin lead near the antenna also not be well shielded? What suddenly changes that, Hal? Go ahead.
There's a certain frequency that the mismatch at the feed point to the twin lead is going to radiate.
Okay. If the feed line is always being used in a balanced manner, in a differential manner, even though there may be standing wave ratio, that in itself does not create radiation. Only when you've got common mode signal on the feed line will it radiate. If all the signal on the feed line is thoroughly differential, even if the antenna has a high VISWR and there's power bouncing back and forth on that transmission line, that is still a shielded structure by the books that I read them. Hal, go ahead.
The field density, you'll see it's radiating. You have a field that's leaving the ladder line.
Okay. Does it do it differently near the shack than near the antenna? Over to you, Hal.
Depends on the frequency.
If I choose a frequency where it is more at one than the other, where is it more?
Well, it depends on the size of the antenna, number one, and the length of the feed line. You got too many variables there, Dick, and the tuner is mainly matching the driving impedance. Go ahead, take it back, Dick. I'm just listening. I just want to throw my comment in. K6DPZ.
The reason I'm dwelling on this, Hal, is that you and I right now are into an area with a lot of misunderstanding. Let me ask you a very direct question. No matter what length of feed line I choose, whether it's a length that is resonant or non-resonant, if I'm using it in a thoroughly differential manner, with or without standing wave ratio, will twin lead radiate at a reasonable frequency? If I'm using 600 ohm open wire line at 80 meters, I'll allow you to choose whatever length of open wire line you like. I'll allow you to choose any standing wave ratio you like. I'll allow you to choose any kind of antenna on the far end that you like. Is there anything that K6DPZ can do to that open wire line on 80 meters being properly used in a balanced differential manner? Is there anything that you can do that will make that open wire line radiate? That's a yes or a no. Please tell me your answer on that one, Hal.
If you don't have the line terminated at a proper impedance at the other end, it's going to radiate. It's not going to be a pure differential match.
Oh, really? If I've got a floating 600 ohm load at the far end, and I suddenly make it a dead short circuit at the far end. Now, let's not go that far. Let me make it a 50 ohm resistor at the far end of 600 ohm line. By definition now, I've got something like a 50 to 1 standing wave ratio. Does that make the open wire line radiate? Over to you, Hal.
Yes.
I say absolutely not. And you and I have got a strong difference of opinion on this one. We're not going to settle it tonight. I say, as long as the signal you're launching is thoroughly balanced, using it in a thoroughly differential manner, as long as the load on the far end, no matter what that load is a balanced load, even though it's mismatched, open wire line with standing wave ratio used in a balanced manner, I say does not radiate. I'll admit that what you're saying, Hal, is a very popular opinion. You've got a lot of good company on your side, and I'm fighting a losing battle here. I say it does not radiate. Eventually, you and I might settle this. We're not going to settle it tonight. I'm just registering the fact that everything I know says it will not radiate per se. Yes, if I'm a electromagnetic interference person, and my definition of radiation of a transmission line is that there's a signal sneaking out of there that's 40 decibels below some reference, an EMI person will call that radiation. A ham radio operator will say, no way, that's a 10S unit down. That's not radiation. That's just a little tiny bit of leakage. Except for that phenomenon, I say that twin lead itself, with VISWR, does not radiate. I know that you've got the other opinion. We'll both dig into this a little bit deeper, Rahel. Back to you for any other final comments. You've got the popular opinion. I've got the unpopular one. Over to you, Hal.
And KC2QIQ with a comment.
Take the comments.
Okay, Hal first. Go ahead, Hal.
Well, I've seen it with a field transmitter running along a balanced ladder line. So that's why I'm saying it that way. Go ahead, make your comments.
If I hold a field strength meter close enough to one wire compared to the other, if I'm not holding a balanced field strength meter in a symmetric manner to those two wires, and I'm standing 3 inches away from it, yes, I'll see signal. But that is not radiation. That's a reactive near field effect. Stand back 50 feet and measure the amount of signal coming from the transmission line, and you've got to have some way of differentiating it from what's coming out of the antenna. By putting a good shield of dummy load at the far end, you can do that. I say it does not radiate. KC2QCQ, go ahead, Glenn. You got it, K2RIW.
Hey, good evening, Dick. Good evening, Hal, too. I just wanted to mention, Hal, this was something that Dick and I had discussed a while ago, and I actually got, I took out some ladder line, 400 ohm ladder line, and coax of a couple of different types, and I really wanted to see, by taking multiple mismatches and connecting them up with a tuner on the other end, and drive this ladder line and see all of the radiation I was expecting to see off of it. And I took a near-field sniffer probe, and I brought it near the via the twin lead, and I was shocked at how quiet it really was. As a matter of fact, I could almost make an argument that I saw less coming off of the ladder line than I saw coming off of coax. I was completely shocked at that one. It's tighter than you think. I do believe if you take a sniffer probe and you go right next to it, or within like an inch, what you're going to read is going to be a very delivery, the non-canceled part of the high current energy, almost like a current probe pickup. But once you back away from it, even more than a foot, and, you know, 2 feet, it's amazing how well shielded the lateral line is. It completely blew my mind. It was not what I was going to expect. And then I took it one step further. I went to a short circuit on the other end, and even with some kind of mismatch that my tuner wouldn't even complete, because the amplifier had some VSWR protection, it still didn't leak. I was completely shocked. Back to you, Dick. K2RAW, KC2, QIQ.
Yeah, what you're saying, Hal, is an extremely popular opinion. You can hear it so many times that everyone begins to believe it, and it has the ring of good common sense. But when you get down to a real measurement, and it looks like Glenn did, you've now got a fairly strong piece of evidence that it might not be true, and I really believe it's not true. Okay, I think that's enough of that for one night. And by the way, well, I know that's not a closed issue. I know that a lot of people out there believe that open wire line with standing wave ratio is a strong radiator. I say properly used in a differential manner, it is not. And even though you can put a sniffer near it, a field strength meter, and if you're inches away, you'll think you're seeing radiation. It might not be real. It could be a reactive near field effect. And there's a whole set of scientific measurements you can make. In other words, there's a whole technique that's being used these days of making near field measurements of an antenna with a very fancy probe, where you scan the probe across the aperture of the antenna, and you carefully measure amplitude and phase of what is the apparent radiated signal in each location, and you go into the right kind of a Fourier transform-like computer program, and you can take all of your near field measurements, which are very convenient in a small laboratory, and reflect them into, in other words, predict what the far-field radiation is going to be, even though you didn't have the resources to build a far-field antenna range. So that's becoming a popular technique these days. Near-field measurements, far-field emulation or simulation. Alan, KC2RFN, you're the next guy on the list. And what kind of mischief have you been stirring up this week? You got it, Alan, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Dick, I have one more question on that before you leave it.
Yeah, okay, wait for the beep and go ahead, Glenn.
Why, Dick, I want to finish.
Okay, yeah. Glenn first and then Mel in that order. Go ahead, Glenn.
The only question I have, Dick, is just a matter of, like, terms and words, I guess. In other words, when I think of a lateral line, I'm always thinking that the signal going down one end of the wire and the signal that's returning down the other end of the wire are kind of, like, balanced. So, in other words, it almost would appear to me like a common mode filter. The current going down must be the current returning down the other side. So I would think of that as a common mode structure. Now, you're referring to this as differential. So the differential to me would be the load on the end, but the line itself would be common mode. But maybe you could just say a word or two more about, you know, why you would call the lateral line itself the differential mode. Granted, it must be differential mode feeder, but itself is actually really acting like a common mode structure. That's the way at least I'm envisioning it, but maybe you can add a few more words to that. KC2QIQ.
Yeah, we're now into a vocabulary situation, and I think the IEEE definition of electronic terms will help on this one. Assume I've got 400 ohm or 600 ohm or 300 ohm twin lead lateral line, call it what you like. And when it comes to studying structures like that, and a structure like that is a counter-directional coupler, where you really, internal to the coupler, have two similar impedance lines lying parallel to each other, a quarter wavelength long. That's what's inside of a good, not a type of coaxial directional coupler. And there they talk about measuring the Z-odd and Z-even. And the Z-odd is what impedance you measure in the differential mode, and Z-even is what impedance you measure in the common mode. Let me go one step further. I've got 400 ohm line, open lateral line in front of me, and I'm about to feed it. If at this instant of time I put plus 1 volt on the right-hand wire and minus 1 volt on the left-hand wire, at this instant of time, on the peak of my sine wave of my RF energy, that is called differential mode. If at the next instant of time, on the next test, I put plus 1 volt on the right-hand wire and plus 1 volt on the left-hand wire during this half cycle, and
the next half cycle, it'll be minus on the right-hand wire and minus 1 volt on the left-hand wire. That is common mode. So feeding the two identical voltage with reference to, I'm going to call it ground, that's called